Thank you for joining us on our journey here to preserve the history of mixed martial arts. When I wanted to take on this project, I needed help. I brought in one of my favorite matchmakers, Miguel Iturralde, and the MMA detective, Mike Davis. So to do this, we've been able to preserve history. Welcome and enjoy. Okay, very excited about this next one. Deep dive with not only a fantastic fighter, but a great friend of mine, Matt Mitrione. I'm super excited about this one.
I agree. And Chris, I know you two have a bond. Matt liked to gym jump a little bit, but the one consistent thing was that you were always in this corner, which allowed us a little more insight than the average interview would get. On a side note, Crowbar, dude, you're the man. Thank you for all your help. Please like, share, subscribe. If you guys have got information in regards to like the independent grind, please email it to us. You can find our link in the bio.
Yep. And Matt Mitrione is an interview I'm psyched to do. A heavyweight, who he's fought, a whole list of things. A character, you know, from the UFC, beyond the UFC TV shows. Like, he's got, you know, I want to get beyond that persona and see what we get out of him. Because I think that, you know, with his football career and stuff like that, I think that meathead is an act. I don't know. I don't know about it. So we'll find out. And I'm looking forward to it.
Also want to give a quick shout out to Striker Supreme. Really appreciate you put that post on the underground. That was huge for us, helping us grow. Thank you very much. Keep it up. Without further ado, Matt Mitrione. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you so much for paying attention to Lights Out Podcast. Very excited about this. You know, we love doing these deep dives, and a lot of times I'll be in here and I like some of the people involved. Sometimes I don't, but usually I do. But this time, this is one of my favorite people, not only in the sport, but just pretty much in the world. I love hanging out with this guy and put on some many, many great fights. So were my bonus ones. I didn't like that. We'll get into all that. But Matt Mitrione. Matt, how you doing, brother?
What's up, brother? Thanks a lot for having me on. I'm flattered. You know you're my homie and my mentor, my best buddy. So I'm really flattered you didn't have me on, man. Thank you.
Shit, dude, this is fantastic. You know, I just can't wait to get in and talk about it. You got some really amazing stories, especially. I can't wait for you to talk about, you know, your time on The Ultimate Fighter, because I don't think people really understand exactly what happened there. But how this usually goes, Miguel over here at the top, he matchmaker for Hook and Shoot and Bodog and whatnot. Then we got the MMA detective down here. So he's dissected your career very intently. So we're going to go. He's got notes. His dude's way more prepared than me. So we're going to get into it. So go ahead,
Mike. Pony who can't wrestle. Big notes.
Well, all right. I try not to start the interview hot. Chris, I do not want you to answer. This is a question from Matt, because I asked Chris, and I don't think he was being honest with me. On The Ultimate Fighter, you got on with no fights recorded. Did you and Chris set up a fake fight in order to get some footage to send to the people in Vegas?
No, we did not.
Damn, I thought I had it.
You fought You fought somewhere. Some shitty fight down in... Where was that? Didn't you fight somebody, knock him out like a stomach punch or something?
It was in Louisville.
Okay, and it was down south, yeah.
Remember, and they grabbed a dude out of the crowd. Remember that? And it was like a Marine or something like that.
I knew what lasted about 15 seconds.
Like, it was a Marine, and he was drinking. We were drinking with him right next door. Because we didn't know what was going to happen. We're like, all right, fuck it, man, let's go.
So
it's wild, man, like how MMA has changed so much and like in a 12-year span, like yeah. It has been so incredibly different. Like there's no way stuff that used to fly when I got into it, and especially when you shit.
Yeah, so things Matt, are, it's a different sport.
Matt, did you know that you had a shot at being on The Ultimate Fighter before you took that pull from the audience fight? Is that why you drove to Louisville? Or was it just to kind of get one under your belt?
No, we actually went for other people, and I don't remember who it was, but we went for somebody else, and we were like, well, I mean, if we're here, might as well, to hell with it, you know, might as well get down. And then, and like I said, it was they pulled a drunk dude from the crowd, and then like we kept training, like it was just a normal thing, like okay, that's just, you know, it wasn't anything significant. And then we found out that the Ultimate Fighter was doing, first of all, I found out that there was a TV show called Ultimate Fighter. And then they told me that the Ultimate Fighter was doing heavyweights. And then they asked me to make a video that was obnoxious. So I made an obnoxious video, and then apparently Danny liked it enough to send me in.
Did Chris make a phone call to help you with that process?
That's a Chris question.
Chris?
Yeah, I believe I didn't talk to him, but like I got a guy playing in the NFL. I was going to go back and do a little bit of a, you know, I always ask people about their background for people who don't know. Matt, tell me your athletic background. What did you play? I mean, because you were, obviously you said you weren't a wrestler. So what did you do?
Yeah. So I played football at Purdue University, and I played from 97-01. Drew Brees and I were in the same recruiting class. And then, as a matter of fact, we actually just had our Rose Bowl reunion from 2000. So it was a 20-year – 2001. It was a 20-year Rose Bowl reunion this like 2 weeks ago.
Nice.
So Brees and I were in the same class. We were roommates for a while. And then after that, I was in the NFL for about 4 years. Not four seasons, but 4 years. And then I took 2 years off. Or when the NFL got done with me, I started a company. And then that's what kind of indirectly led me into the UFC.
Did you make the pension for the NFL?
I'm two games short. 3 years, one game.
Ah,
man. That's the way it goes.
I remember when I first met Matt, I said, well, why don't you just try and go back and get two games? And he looked at me like that was the dumbest thing ever. He's like, mm-hmm. Yeah, I tried. I broke my foot. I was like, oh, trust okay. Yeah. That makes trust sense.
Well, what positions did you play, though? Just
I was a pass rusher. So when I was in college, I was a run-stopping defensive tackle. I was a three technique or a nose guard. And then when I got to the NFL, I realized I was nowhere near strong enough to be a defensive tackle or big enough to be a D tackle. So they made me a pass rushing three technique. And I actually adjusted that very well. I think I led the NFL in sacks in the preseason, which doesn't say shit. But I led it in the sacks in the preseason in 2001, I think, maybe 2002. And then I think I did it again in 2005 with the Vikings. But it was an interesting experience. But I just realized I wasn't good enough or strong enough to be in the NFL. I was good enough to get a paycheck for a couple of years, steal a little bit of money, but I wasn't good enough to be there.
Now, what three teams did you play for again? You played for the Giants?
My first 2 years were the Giants. My second year, my third year was with the 49ers, but I was never active with the 49ers. And then I was with the Vikings in 05 and then back again in 08. I was active with the Giants and the Vikings, though.
Okay, so like you said, you were 2001, you were on a Rose Bowl team. Am I correct?
Yeah.
How did that stack up against playing with Ryan Wells and Eric Wells and Bill Bruni and Steve Lynch? How about the 1995 Sacred Heart Griffin football team that took second in the state to Providence?
That's some real homework. Providence, well, I tell you what, man, we were supposed to get blown out by them. That was such a heartbreaker. You know what, man?
Did that hurt?
Yeah, it just still does. you know, it was it's interesting, you know, like for lack of a better way to say it, there is a very special place in any athlete's heart for their high school team, you know, like there's so much you go through and grow up with. And it's the same way in college, but it's a different, like you're kind of already an adult in college, right? Like you party, you do more drugs, you do a bigger variety of drugs, you bang more chicks. But you don't have like the growing pangs of like your parents, your homework, your this and that anymore. So it's weird. It's such a complicated bevy of emotions to talk about those two. But I talk with a hell of a lot more high school guys than I do college guys, for sure.
You know what's crazy? Like, I love high school football, especially in Illinois. And Sacred Heart Griffin has got a historic program. And
yeah.
I was actually at that game. And because Mount Carmel played right after you against Maine South, I coached boxing at Mount Carmel. So it was like I saw some of my students there. And I think Todd Schneller on defense and Eric Wells is a running back, your offensive line. You guys, in my opinion, had one of the best teams in the entire state. It came up short.
We were good, man. You know, it's it was tough, man. We were supposed to get blown out. We were winning. You know, it's weird. Like, it's still, that game still affects me when I watch when I watch football, right? Like, when I watch football in general, we were beating the Providence. Providence is like the number nine team in the nation or some bullshit like that.
Yeah.
Some arbitrary made up something. You know, it was interesting because they were so good, but we had such a squad. But we were winning 17-7 against them, and we ended up losing, I think, 22-7.
22-7,
yeah. And so, like, now when I watch football and I see a team up 17-7, I'm like, they're going to lose. Like, it's just going to happen. Like I'm scarred for life at the number 17-7.
When you talk to high-end professional athletes, whenever you talk about, like, either the five most greatest moments of their career or the ones that hurt the most, a high school like situation always pops up. And one of them, like even with Chris was a runner up for his high school wrestling.
Yeah.
Like, it hurts.
You know what? Like I keep saying, though, that's what I think made me work harder, because I was like, I see all the things I did wrong. I have a second chance. You know, you don't get a second chance in life, but I'm going to correct these mistakes I made from wrestling. I'm going to correct it now in fighting, because I'm an adult. You know, I just, yeah, man, you don't have enough frame of reference, and that means everything in the world to you in high school. You know, now that doesn't mean everything in the world to you, so it doesn't hurt as bad, but it means everything back then.
You know, that's interesting, because, you know, it's there's so much that you like you said, you think you understand when you're in high school, and like, oh, it's the biggest deal ever. It's so much drama, blah, blah, blah. And like, the fact that you failed at something is the driver for so much more. Yeah. And you've accomplished so much more than you ever probably would have if you ever won. Like, there's some people that are just so innately gifted, like Gable Stevenson, right? He's just so much different than everybody else in the world for the most part. Where I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm not saying it's effortless, but he is a casual great. And he's so good. You know Gable Stevenson is, obviously, right?
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Like, he's so great at what he does, and he's so capable that, like, he can do whatever he wants in that world, and he'll still be exponentially better than the next best guy. He's just that guy. He's a once-in-a-lifetime guy. And the rest of us are good, but we're not great. But the fact that we're not great is the driver for us to become something that we never should have been. We become better than the sum of our parts, because motivation and ego and pride are what drive me. I don't know about anybody else, but the fact that I want to be something that other people look at and be like, wow, that dude wasn't supposed to accomplish a thing. He was supposed to be just this, and then he did this much more. And that inspires me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you can see that, like, in your development. All right. Your first fight is in Louisville, where you guys pull a guy out of the audience. You get your one fight in. It should be on your record. I'd like to see it. And then you go on to the Ultimate Fighter Season 10, where you fight Scott Junk. Is that the first time you had ever been punched in a fight?
Yes. Never.
Real quick, man, I was hoping you could go back. Like, you had a tough time on the show, and I want you to tell the story of how that happened and why it happened and what exactly went down.
You really want me to tell that story?
Oh, hell yeah. Why would you not? A lot of people don't know it. And it explained a lot, because, you know, like you said, when you came off the show, it wasn't a great experience. A lot of people thought you were a jackass, and I'd like for people to see why.
Okay. Well, so earlier when you asked if Chris made a call, and I said that's a Chris question, because I don't know how Chris wanted to answer that.
Whatever.
So, yes, Chris made a call to Ken Pavia. Ken Pavia was Chris's manager. Well, Pav ended up calling the UFC, telling them that he knew they were doing a heavyweight version of Ultimate Fighter, and that Chris had a dude, so he had a dude that he would put his name on. And so they were interested in it. Are they arguing downstairs too loud? Are you okay?
Go ahead, bro. Fine. It's all right. We've dealt with much worse. I got a train that runs through here.
Murphy.
15 minutes.
So the Pav calls me up the night before we leave for the Ultimate Fighter. And he says, hey, listen, I got a dude out in Hawaii. He's going on Ultimate Fighter also. He wants to set up an alliance with you. And I think it's a really good idea. You should give him a call. Now, Chris can validate every single thing I'm saying. So Chris, give it a shake of the head or a nod of the head if I do.
Oh, yeah. Inappropriate. Okay.
So Pav calls me up, says, I got a dude named Scott Junk. He wants you to call him. He's out in Hawaii. So give him a call. We reported literally the next day, like tomorrow we report. So I call this. I'm like, well, I call Chris up and I'm like, listen, dude, I don't know anybody in MMA. I don't know anything about MMA. I don't have any friends in MMA. And I was like, but what do you think about this option? He's like, listen, if you can get a friend there and kind of help you learn the ropes and kind of get you through some stuff, I don't think it's a bad bet. So I'm like, all right, well, you know what? Cool. So I call up Junk, and Junk is at the mall with his wife and his daughter. And he's like, listen, what I want to do, he's like, I don't know you, but Pav says you're cool. So what I want to do is if we are on separate teams, we share information, we get each other through the first round. And then if we get into the second round, we fight each other, all bets are off, I'm going to try to kill you. And I was like, well, since I don't know anybody, it doesn't hurt me to have a friend. So sure, why not? And I had been training, Chris. We've been training for maybe 6 months.
Probably not even that long.
Yeah. It's the only other heavyweight there is Jake O'Brien that you're training with. Am I correct?
That's it. That's it. Yeah.
So you've been training with one heavyweight for 6 months.
We had Ed Jones. We had a training partner, but he wasn't like a UFC guy.
Was Mike Camp still there with you guys rolling at this time? Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
You never met him.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I think I know him. But then, again, I don't know anybody. So, like, well, anyways, so Chris, say something.
No, I was going to say. So, by the way, at this point, Matt doesn't know anybody. They were on the show and they were saying something about Randy Couture and everything, and he'd be like, who are you talking about? And they thought it was joking. He didn't know any fighters. He didn't know anybody.
I didn't know anybody. I'm like, well, explain to me what you mean by we get each other through the first round. He's like, listen, we share information about who we're fighting, what they're practicing, what the style is, how to beat them, and then we go from there. Like, but second round, everything's off. Because the reason was, which I found out later, is back in the day, if you got through the first round, then you got invited to the finale, no matter what. So he wanted to get through the first round because he knew if he got past the first round, then we're in the finale together, or we're going to be in the finale. Even if you lost in the quarterfinals, it didn't matter. Okay, cool, man. So I said yes. So we go on the Ultimate Fighter. We're on the show for about, it's a 6 week long taping. And you're totally sequestered from everybody in any which way, any form, whatever else. So we go on the show. We're on there for 2 weeks. And then by that time, Rashad and Rampage had already picked the teams. I was on Rashad's team. I wanted to be on Rashad's team because I knew that Rashad was a wrestler. I knew nothing about Rampage, but I knew that Rashad was a wrestler. So I figured he could help me out. Rashad picks me whenever he picked me. And then I was supposed to fight Marcus Jones. And Junk was going to fight his roommate, Justin Wren. And Justin, him and Justin knew each other. Scott Junk and Justin knew each other. And then that affected Justin in some type of way. He was upset about it. Well, then I went over that night, and I actually had a great plan. I was drinking cereal, like milk out of a bowl. And I, because like we always wore the, like this octagon necklace, and that had a microphone attached to it. So I drank this bowl, and I was telling Junk that he was fighting, or who we each were fighting, into the bowl so that my voice would reverberate and you wouldn't be able to catch on the microphone because it wasn't clean audio. Because I knew they were going to catch it and utilize it somehow. So I manipulated my voice. They couldn't and go to bed. And I go to bed that night, and I chose to sleep in a closet because I didn't want to have a roommate and I didn't want to have other people around me all the time. So I slept in a closet in a single bed, and it was fine. It was great for me because the only time people ever went in there was a morning or at nighttime. That was it, or right before practice. So it was a really good space for me to sleep in and kind of chill and have my own autonomy, if you will. So then I go to sleep, but I wake up, I come upstairs, and I'm getting ready to get breakfast. My team, Rashad's team, practiced first in the morning. So I go there, and James McSweeney is like, I toast a bagel. And he's like, hey, man, do you want some peanut butter for that bagel? And I was like, yeah, sure, man. There was some peanut butter out on the table. I was like, yeah, sure, man. He's like, why don't you go ahead and take that knife out of Justin's back and go ahead and put it on that bagel? And I was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, everybody fucking knows you're scared to fight, what's his name, Marcus Jones. So you fucking snitched on him. They're trying to throw everything under the bus. And at the time, there was a $5 million conferring with other contestants policy. So I couldn't say, be like, oh, well, this is what happened, and blah, blah, blah. So I just had to eat it and be like, yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I snitched. That's what happened, blah, blah, blah. I couldn't be like, listen, this whole thing was set up from the time we even walked in the door. Like, blah, blah, blah. Like, I was introduced by what went on. So all I did was hold up my end of the bargain that this motherfucker brought up to me. Okay. I couldn't.
Now, Junk told everybody what Matt said.
No.
He told everybody.
No. Chris, yeah. This is what happens. This is what's going on. So what you're saying is the UFC should sue Ken Pavia for setting this up.
What I'm saying is Bobby is not involved. That's what I'm saying.
But the Joke did go and tell all his teammates, I found all this out from Matt Mitrione. He said, you're fighting this guy. He spilled the beans and told his team that not only did he knew, but Matt was the one who did it. So he said he pulled the knife out of Max's back.
So I couldn't just snitch on the situation. So I was like, well, yeah.
He's got to eat it. He just got to eat it.
So that's what I was like, well, fuck it. Like, I'm a strong, because I've been there for 2 weeks. I only had 4 weeks left. And I was like, listen, my personality is so big. I'll turn this whole fucking show on its ear. And I'll make it all about me. Like, I'm not, I have no fear about ever getting upstaged in any situation. Because I'm too arrogant and I'm too much of an asshole to let that happen. So I was like, fuck it. If you're going to snitch on me, I'll make this show about me all day long. And that's what I did. So I played a character just to keep myself entertained because nobody would talk to me. Nobody wanted to get involved with me.
You're stuck in a house alone. You have to.
No, and not only am I in a house alone, I'm in a house alone with two other genuine alpha males and a bunch of other dudes that want to act like they are. Like, there's a couple of dudes that are real genuine. You meet them like, oh, I respect that dude. And there's a bunch of other dudes when you meet them, you're like, nah, not so much.
Right. Give us the guys who you respect in that house.
I respected Kimbo.
Okay.
And in my opinion, even though he was a friend of mine, I respected Brendan Shaw. Because I knew that Brendan played football, had been to the ringer. But if I were to say who else was an alpha male, who else did I feel like was a grown ass man in that room, was the other Wes. Wasn't Wes Sims. It was the other dude. Big fella from Alabama. No. I like Daryl though. I like Daryl a lot. Daryl and I stayed in contact for years. Like a decade after that show. But it was the other dude. The dude from Alabama or something like that. Played football.
Okay. All right. So, like, for instance, you're talking about your experience with The Ultimate Fighter. So then how does it come, like, full circle where you fight Scott Junk as your first fight?
Well, that was a very manipulative process. I knew that Mike Wessel, God, I haven't thought of these names in a long time. I knew that Mike Wessel was fighting Scott Junk. So I manipulated Mike Wessel the best I could, talking about how tough Junk must be and how he'd already fought in K1. He'd already fought in the UFC. He already was so accomplished and he was a stand-up guy. And Jesus, that was such a tough fight. I'm a stand-up guy. Let me fight him instead. You go fight a grappler. Because I think Mike Wessel had already fought in the UFC also, maybe. Or at least he was accomplished in some form. And as a result, I think I nagged Mike Wessel so much that they were in a point like, okay, we'll just switch it up. And that's all I wanted to do. All I wanted to do was manipulate every variable I could to make sure I got to fight Scott Junk. And that's the reason I fought him the way I did, because I think I dropped him like five times. You know? But I was so angry, I didn't want to finish him. I wanted to punish him. I wanted to hurt him because that fucker sold me out. And it was his idea he sold me out on and made me look like a hoe. And I knew that there was nothing I could do to make me look any better. I was sold at the river regardless. So I was like, fuck it. Well, I'm going to take him down with me. Let me hoe that dude the only way I can. And that was it.
It's really your only option. You know, I mean, it's if he sold you out, then you got to get him first. That's the only solution.
You had a great mind game going in, but let me ask you, how was Rashad with you? Because at this point, I think it's fair to say you probably have less training than everybody else there. You're also trying to soak it all in. How did Rashad handle you? Was he cool with you? Did you feel like you were learning, or were you completely on your own?
You know, dude, Rashad was great. Great. He was so great and was so understanding and was so patient. I did dumb things on the show. Everybody does, you know. And I screwed up plenty that was off camera. Said dumb things, you know. And it's hard. It's a very difficult environment to be in. Which I never would have respected if I wasn't in that situation to know what it was. Like, I was married to my first wife at the time. My oldest son was 3 and a half. My baby son was 2 months old. You're literally sequestered away where there's no media of any form. Like, there's no telephone, no TV, no newspaper, no magazines, no radio, driving to and from 45 minutes each way. So 3 hours a day in a car, in a club van with 8 other dudes that are as big as you with no radio. Like, that's for 3 hours a day, that's a long go. And it was a lot. And so luckily, I'm intelligent enough to find out ways to manipulate those systems. And I was able to capitalize on it later on. But Rashad was genuine. He was exactly who I found him to be in real life. He's always been great to me. No matter what dumb things I say or do, he understood the context of it. Listen, you're not in a normal environment, so I don't hold this against you. You're in this situation or that situation. Or after the show, hey, listen, man, like, I know your heart and I know you want this. So let's work for that. Let's do this. Rashad is a nurturer. He's not combative. He just happened to be good at it. And so for him to have somebody that he knew respected him and wanted his A, approval, and B, his mentorship and his input and his knowledge tickled him, especially with somebody with a life like mine. I was an NFL guy before. And I told him, I was like, listen, I may be wrong, but I'm the best damn athlete here and I'm more aggressive than these dudes. They don't have the same mentality that I do. And Rashad understood that. And that's why Rashad and I always got along.
Cool. So your second fight against James McSweeney, it's not an easy situation for you because you don't have a lot of MMA experience. Like, you didn't even know who Randy Couture was. Now you're in a house full of guys, pretty much like MMA library, and casual conversations in regards to the sport, like you're still catching up. It couldn't have been an easy situation to be in.
It was not an easy situation, but I was better than James McSweeney, and I knew I was better than him. But I also knew I was better than everybody else there. Like, I didn't have the wherewithal to prove it, but I knew that I was different. Well, maybe not Roy. I didn't know I was better than Roy. I think Roy, I thought, was just fat. I didn't know much about him. And then once I found out who he was and who he'd fought and he'd done all these things or whatever else, oh, cool, man. But Roy and I were cool on the show. Like, we didn't have issues on the show. I just thought he was kind of arrogant, right? Like, my impression from Roy was that what Roy said was Roy's Bible. Like, it didn't matter if it was true or not. It was Roy's Bible. And that's all that mattered. Like, it was his, whatever he said was his own gospel. And my experience of that was, okay, cool, right? Like, I didn't know enough about him. It was a very challenging environment to be in. But with James McSweeney, I didn't want to be on the show anymore. I didn't want to be competing anymore. I didn't want the pressure. I didn't like it. It was my first flavor to it, and I had had enough. So I went in. If it was stand-up, I'd have knocked his ass out. And then I can't remember what happened. I think he might have taken me down or something against the wall. And I was like, you know, I'll go for a heel hook. And then he went up for a choke, and I was like, cool. Sounds great. I don't want to do it anymore. And that was my experience with James McSweeney. It wasn't positive, wasn't the best experience of my life competitively, but I knew I just didn't want to be there anymore.
So with Scott Junk, after your fight, I mean, you worked it perfect. You got him in the first round. Was there any other confrontations or conversations in regards to you guys that wasn't on camera?
Nah, because fuck him.
You tell Pavia that too afterward?
Yeah, he's not my time. What's that?
You told Pavia that too, I'm assuming, afterward, huh?
Oh, yeah, I laid into that motherfucker for sure. Yeah. He tried to tell me, he's like, I'm not going to represent you because, you know, they said you didn't come off very well and whatever else. He's like, bitch, fuck you. I was like, how fucking dare you try to tell me you won't cover me? That wouldn't let you lick the sweat off my balls. Fuck you. And I was furious. I was irate with him. And I think I might have had one polite conversation with him afterwards. Like, you did me dirty. Like, you sold me up the river to somebody that you either didn't know well enough, and now you did it, you're going to try to throw me under the bus and be like, ugh, you're kind of hands off? Fuck off.
You know, and the one thing about yourself was, after coming out of The Ultimate Fighter, because of the way they intentionally portrayed you, I don't think anybody really thought you had the legs that you did. And
no, for sure,
no. So here, let's start with your first fight, December 5th, 2009, the Tough 10 finale. You get Marcus Jones, and there's legit bad blood coming from Marcus.
Marcus was a show favorite, and I was told, I don't know how they figured this, quantified this, but I was told that he had a 87% fan approval rating. I was told I had a 93% fan disapproval rating. That was it. That's all I knew about going into that fight. That's it. And they played the wrong walkout song walking out.
So Marcus Jones is a Tampa guy. I think he was on a Bucks Super Bowl team. And he was training jiu-jitsu with a guy that we had interviewed in one of our first few, Rob Kahn. So he was in legit camp in Tampa and a huge athlete. And the bad blood between you two, it was almost palpable. Did that bother you at all?
No. I revel in uncomfortable situations. I flourish in them.
I think in that first fight, the most impressive thing was your ability to stay calm. I mean, it's your third MMA fight, fourth. I mean, the one in, you know, Louisville didn't count. Mm. Your ability to stay calm and in between rounds – you're sitting on a stool and you got Chris and Pat McPherson and they're like, and you were like, oh, how am I doing? And they said, good day at the office. Good day at the office. They were more nervous than you were because they knew how green you were. And you're just like, all right, man, I'm just figuring this out. Just tell me if I'm doing good. I've never seen Chris and Pat so nervous in their life. And it was because,
you know, he caught me in a guillotine, right? In the first round, and
you stay calm.
I had literally just learned that defense of TPing and allowing him to take pressure. But if I TP, like put my butt in the air and keep my head on the ground, and walk my feet towards me, it'll take pressure off of my neck and off of his choke. So I literally just learned that by accident because Jake O'Brien did it like maybe a week and a half before. And I had learned it by accident. It wasn't on purpose. It was Jake did it. And I was like, why'd you do that? And he's like, oh, because it takes pressure off. It makes it easier. So I was in a situation that I didn't expect to be in, even though we knew a guillotine was kind of his thing. And Jake, I tried to hit it on Jake. He walked up. And then I was like, wow, okay. So that was, I never even tried it in practice. That was the first time I had ever done that TP was in that moment, in that fight. And that's why like I was sitting there, I was like, wow, it actually works. And I wasn't giving the referee the thumbs up really. I was giving the corner the thumbs up, like, hey, this shit actually works. Like, wow. Like that's crazy to me.
That is amazing shit, man. That's amazing stuff. But your football really, we interviewed Eric Anders, who was on Alabama's national championship team. Mm-hmm. And you got it. That being cool in front of a crowd and you know, being a dominant personality and stuff, football really gave you a good jump start on the mind game for this as while the technique caught up. And then, you know, the athleticism helps, but big time football does put a lot of pressure on you.
It does. That's accurate. I think one of the biggest things I learned was it's just a moment. It's just a moment. Now there may be a significant collection of moments, but it's just a moment. Play by play, strike by strike, right? Like in football, it's one play at a time, one down at a time, one quarter time, one half at a time. That's it. That's all it is. So in fighting, it correlates over to one landed strike at a time, one missed strike at a time, one landed strike at a time, right? Like one takedown at a time, one get up at a time. That's it. Like they're literally just moments in how you respond to them. And if it flustrates you, or if you're visibly flustered, well, that conversation is going to be pretty damn different now. Mm-hmm. But if you keep it cool, all right, well, like what are they saying in Pulp Fiction? Be cool, honey bunny, right? Like, tell that fucking bitch to chill, right? So if you bug out and start tripping, then everybody's going to notice that you're bugging out and starting tripping. Mm-hmm. But if you don't, like, there was a fight, Karatanov. Sergey Karatanov hit me with a jab. And this jab hurt so fucking bad. Like it was out of every punch that's ever been landed in my entire career. This jab fucked me up. Like my whole entire body went numb. And my face was hot and red, and it was holy shit. And I thought to myself, fuck, this is going to suck. And I was like, mm-hmm. Well, no matter. And I remember like everything in my soul, like it is not to be dramatic at all, but like literally everything in my soul was like, fucking bail, run away. And then I just felt my feet moving forwards. And I was like, and as soon as I had that thought of like, holy shit, that was so, that I can't believe that a single punch did that to me. I remember like the next thought was, fuck him. If you let him see that hurt, he's going to murder you. And I was like, so I just kept walking forwards and I couldn't feel my arms or my legs really, I don't think. But like I started throwing jabs or a straight just so I could make him move back and not realize how bad that punch hurt. And I remember at that moment, God, it's so wild, like in hindsight, right? Like I remember at that moment being like, holy shit, you just did that. Like that I just ate the most bitchy, devastating punch I've ever had. And I let my balls drop on it and walk through it so he wouldn't know how much that thing sucked. And I remember like, I was like, I'm so proud of you. Like it was like a pat myself on the back moment. And I was like, it was just, it was such an odd situation that I would find myself in, that it was just one of those moments, man. I don't know how to, you know.
The one thing that I took away from that first fight, like, it's really your first big fight. So Miguel, Chris always talks about after a fight, the interview, I don't even know what I'm saying.
You're talking about with Marcus?
Yes. So okay. With Marcus Jones. So with Chris, he'll say, 50 Fight Club veteran, man, I don't even know what's coming out of my mouth. You were 100% present in the post-fight interview. You were ready to go from off, you know, things to, that you remembered that you wanted to say when you won. Like, you had walked yourself through that entire situation, which included the post-fight interview. Is that kind of something you do mentally?
Yes. I always expected to win. Always. I may not be the best fighter, but I'm the best athlete. So I always have a chance that most others don't. So I always give myself a position where I know how I'm going to win. I see myself winning, and I know how I'm going to handle or conduct myself afterwards, because I need to make sure that's part of my vision all the time. I'm a mental gymnast, and I put myself through the ringer mentally and emotionally often. But I do it in order to prepare myself for any variable or curveball that comes up.
That's fantastic. So at this point, you can tell, like, the UFC is kind of like, hey, man, I got to win. They're not sold on you yet. And they bring you in as an underdog trying to get a win for Kimbo Slice. And it's 5 months later. So after your fight with Marcus Jones, how much gym time did you put in? Like, to prepare for your second fight?
So that was an interesting situation because we didn't have any heavyweights. I was developing a combination, and I fought lefty. So I threw a right jab, and I noticed that Jake O'Brien was slipping my right jab to his right, which means he's headed to my left. So if I fight lefty, you're slipping my jab to my left. I can throw up a left body kick, right? And that means you're going to dip into my body kick. So I threw a left body kick. Now, granted, at the time, I might not have had as much touch as I did develop, but Jake ducked into my body kick, and I ended up kicking him in his head. And Jake had a bad outcome from it. So Jake was out for a while, wasn't practicing, was a different Jake for a bit. And oh, wow. And so from that, we had no heavyweights to train with anymore. So Coach Pat and Chris pulled me into the office and said, hey, listen, you're at a spot where you've kind of outgrown us because we don't have heavyweights. And it's a completely different fighting style. So we need you to go find a different camp and get ready and prepare for a different life.
Man, I don't mean to interrupt, but that right there tells you they love you. Any coach to tell somebody that you've outgrown us, you're in the UFC, the biggest show, we'd love to ride your coattails.
And Chris was in the UFC. Like, it wasn't like Chris was an afterthought. Chris was in the UFC and told me that.
That's – like, they really cared about you.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. I was flattered, right? Like, because I understood that they were right, and I knew it. I had thought it to myself for a while, but there was nothing I could do about it because I wasn't going to leave, right? So that's how I ended up founding Pat Barry and Duke Rufus. And I go up and start training with Coach Pat, and Coach Duke, and we do an entire fight camp up there. And I used to live in Milwaukee, so I knew some people up there. I could stay with some people up there. I'd go home and see my wife, come back. But I spent, I think, 2 months up there. And Pat became a really good friend of mine, really good friend. Pat and I still talk to this day, actually. I met Rose when she was 15. Like, so I've known them for a long ass time. And we stay in touch. We get random texts. We send pictures. We talk about stuff all the time. Pat and I and Ben Rothwell had some fucking battles. Then we fought Kimbo and I won.
It's a perfect matchup for Kimbo. It's a guy that doesn't wrestle, doesn't have a strong pedigree in stand-up. He's just a big athletic body. So Kimbo doesn't really have to defend a takedown. But I don't think that they understood that you weren't just going to take a few months off, wait for a call, and then start your camp. Like, you took this as a full-time job and put the type of dedication into it that I don't think that the UFC had expected.
I remember I played in the NFL, you know, so I had some money, but I wasn't rich by any stretch at all. I didn't have six digits. I was in a situation where when I beat Marcus, I fought for eight and eight. So I won $16,000 to beat Marcus Jones. And they gave me a $10,000 bonus check. And I remember calling my wife at the time. And I remember being like, they just gave me $10,000 for winning. Like, I just got $26,000. And I was so hyped. And I was like, I can make money doing this. It's not a pastime. I can make money. And then when they offered me Kimbo, I was like, hell yes. Hell yeah. Kimbo and I spoke on the show, Ultimate Fighter, like one of the last days when cameras were pretty much off. And he was like, listen, you know they're going to have us fight each other some, right? And I said, yeah, I kind of figured they would. And he's like, listen, if you stick around, if you win, because we figured that we were in. Both of us were going to be at least personalities enough. We were going to kind of be something more than a conversation or a flash in the pan. And he's like, listen, he's like, they're going to make the crazy white boy versus that dirty black dude. He's like, so he's like, everybody knows it. That's how they're going to play it. He's like, so I wish you success, but I'm coming for you. And I was like, I respect that. And I'll do the same. So once they called his name, neither one of us thought it was going to be that soon at all. We thought it was going to be three or four, maybe five fights on the road. So we found ourselves, we fought, and I turned him into a wrestler. He didn't want to stand up anymore. He wanted to wrestle. And I tried to go for some submissions. I didn't really know what I was doing. Tried to go for the triangle, tried to go for, I think an Americana or key lock, you know. And then he finally just stopped, you know, he gave up. And afterwards he came by and we drank a beer. And he was like, hey, man, I'm proud of you. You did a good job. And then I cut him the next day. And then my entire life was just drastically different after that point.
So you tasted his power. How hard did he hit?
He didn't, because he didn't use his hips. He didn't know how to use his hips. It was all arms. So there was nothing about him that was frightening. The most frightening thing about him was the air about him, the aura that he carried.
It was big.
But, yeah, for sure. That was the most intimidating factor about him. The night before I was anxious, and I don't ever get anxious. It's a very new feeling. Even through the rest of my career, I didn't get anxious at all. Except for one fight, and I'll tell you about that sometime. But so night before I was nervous, and it was a lot of nervous energy. And Ken Pavia came up. And he brought me to the stairwell from the hotel room. I'm in the stairwell, and he's like, hey, don't be nervous. He's like, don't be anxious. He's like, there's no reason for you to be. He's like, nobody expects you to win, so nobody gives a fuck if you lose. He's like, so go be free. He's like, do what they tell me you do in the gym and enjoy yourself. And he's like, and this was unsolicited. And he's like, nobody cares about you because everybody thinks you're a fuck up. He's like, so if you succeed, then you fucked everybody's plans. He's like, and if you don't, then all you did was fit in. He's like, so don't trip. And I remember thinking that. And the next morning, I was still anxious. And Coach Pat, you know Coach Pat?
Yeah, McPherson, good dude. Yeah.
So Coach Pat grabs my laptop. And I'm anxious. And he grabs my laptop and he puts on Britain's Got Talent. And he puts on, I just pulled a blank on her name. It's a woman, she's frumpy. And
she
sings the Cat song.
Yeah, she crushes it. I Dream a Dream from Les Mis.
Yeah. That's one.
He puts her on. Sarah Brightman, maybe? Sarah something.
Boyle. No, Boyle.
Sarah Boyle. Susan Boyle.
Susan Boyle. It.
He puts on Susan Boyle. Mm-hmm. And this is unsolicited again. He puts on her, and he has me watch the entire video. And I don't let him see it, but I start to cry. Like, I'm tearing up. And he goes, this is the visual embodiment of what you're going to do tonight. He's like, everybody disrespects you. Until tonight, you're going to show them who you are, and you're going to tell them to go fuck themselves. He's like, this is who you are, and this is what we know you to be. He's like, this is your moment. And I watched that video probably 15 times that day. And like, it changed the way I viewed my opportunity. And like, it showed me that it wasn't up to that point. I always felt like it was me against the world. I succeeded because fuck everybody else, right? I'm so spiteful and I'm so abnormally independent that I will succeed in the face of failure because fuck you. And at that moment, I realized that it was no longer fuck everybody else. It was us versus them. And like, that was a very aggressive position that I don't know if he meant to convey potential and how people care.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you absolutely. And you literally that night, it stopped all of the bullshit. Like all the people that didn't have the balls to even walk into a gym that are chirping, it shut everybody's mouth, man. It really did.
It was a really interesting moment, you know, like it was very complex for me. Because on fight night, I was so laid back and casual. Pat Barry did such a good fucking job of being Pat Barry, lighthearted and casual. And like, he and I, they introduced me first, right? So like, he and I, there's a video, some fan took a video, and we're, you know, like the cage before the walkout, you know, before you walk through the crowd. There's a video of us dancing behind the curtain because we were so casual and so ready to be like, fuck it, let's go. And like, we were dancing and acting a fool, just being fucking dummies. And Kimbo's 20 yards behind me, serious and woo, yelling and hooting and hollering. And we're dancing like jackasses back there, you know? Like, it was amazing. And like, we got introduced. And then they played the right song this time. They played Simple Man. And then he walked out to All I Do Was Win by like what, Little John or whoever. And I remember thinking like, wow, that's ironic because I'm about to whoop your ass. And then when I won, like I just remember, like, like I knew I was going to win. Once I got there, I knew I was going to win. But it was like the entire day of preparation and the mental gymnastics of that Susan Boyle video. Like, dude, that I'm telling you, like, that changed. I watched that video before every single fight of my career. Like I would always watch it. Like, we would add a couple things in here or there, but we would always watch that Susan Boyle video.
Yeah, okay. Now let me ask you there. You said usually you went, you know, you got by on that me versus the world attitude. You had to have a good bit of that too. I mean, did you have the feeling the UFC wanted Kimbo to win, like, heading into that? Was that part of it also?
Yeah, but I figured that they were going to keep one of us, right? Like, that's what was going to happen. Like, they had too many people from the Ultimate Fighter on there. And I knew that they paid him so much, and they paid me fucking pennies. So it didn't matter. They would have preferred to keep me, but marketing aspect wise, keeping Kimbo would have been great. And I was a warm up fight for him, right? Like it was a great way to raise the awareness of the boogeyman that Kimbo was, mm-hmm. right? And he was a great dude, man. Like personally, we all like Kimbo. He was a really good dude. Like, there was no bitch assness about him at all. It was just a good ass dude. He, like, there was a story I've told this a handful of times. He talked about when we got back home, like I said, we were totally sequestered. Couldn't talk to your wife, couldn't talk to your girl, couldn't do anything. And we were sitting around, it was like story time with Kimbo. And he was like, hey, before you guys left home, did any of you wipe the toilet seat before you left in your master bathroom? And everybody's like, dude, what are you talking about? He's like, did any of you lift up the toilet seat and wipe the porcelain with toilet paper before you left? The fuck kind of question is that? No. Like, what do you mean? Like, who does that shit? And he goes, from now on, anytime you leave to go train, go do a seminar, go do anything, lift up the toilet seat and wipe off the porcelain top. And we were like, what the fuck are you talking about?
It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
He goes, because every dude dribbles piss. So if your wife or your girl has any dude fucking in your bed, he's going to take a piss in the master bathroom and he's going to dribble piss all over the toilet seat. He's like, so if you get back there and there's piss on there after you wiped it off, you know she's stepping out on you when you're out earning money. That's and right. we were like fucking flabbergasted. like the amount of knowledge mm-hmm. and in game you have to think of something like that. Dude, he fucked us up. And that's just like a microcosm of who he was. Like, he was so full, dude. He was so full of gems. Like, he was such a good dude, bro. Like, he was just one of the dudes that he didn't want to be special, didn't want to be Kimbo, didn't want pressure, didn't want a fucking thing. He was a good ass dude. We would come home, both teams, you know, like at nighttime after practice. And that dude would make like 8 or 9 different types of a Carolina barbecue sauce, vinegar base, and he would make these sauces and we'd be like, ooh, Kimbo, make this one. And he'd make like this golden Alpine North Carolina barbecue sauce, and we'd like grill fucking whatever we wanted to do. Like, you could ask for like 3-month-old baby yak from Nigeria and you'd have it in 2 hours. And like, so we'd barbecue all this stuff up, we'd grill it up, and he would pour these sauces all over. He was so much fun to be around. He was such a good dude. Like, Kimbo was a solid dude, bro.
You know, Matt Brown, or Mike Brown, when we had him on, his responses, he wasn't saying he's the greatest in the world. He wasn't saying he's the best in the world and you're nothing. All he said is he's willing to fight the best in the world. And he did. Like, how can you not respect that?
Mike Brown, ATT Mike Brown?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mike Brown's a great fucking soldier, bro. We were on a show together, a fight. We were on a fight card. And I was on the main card. And for some reason, Mike was on the prelim. And somebody called me. Somebody from the UFC called me and said, hey, listen, we already have another guy that's playing Simple Man as his walkout. How do you want us to handle this? And I was like, well, I don't know anybody in the UFC, so I don't know who it is. And they said, well, his name's Mike Brown. He was a WEC champ. He's been around for a long time, but you're on a higher card than him. So if you want him to change it, then we'll have him change it. And I don't know who Mike Brown is at all. So I'm like, well, that doesn't sound right. So I call Mike and I get his number, I call him up. And I'm like, hey, man, the UFC just called. And they said that you walk out the Simple Man. He said, I do. And he's like, I hear you do too. And I said, well, yeah, I do. And he said, he goes, well, I was like, listen, man, if you want me to walk out to something different, then I will. I have no problem with that. It's your song. You've been around long enough. I'm not going to steal your thunder. And he goes, Matt, he goes, I don't know much about you, but the fact you called me and asked me, I really respect it. He's like, I'd be honored if you walk out to the same song I do, because that means we're cut from the same cloth. And that was my first introduction to Mike. And I've met him, I don't know, probably 15, 25 times since then. And he's always been courteous and great, forthcoming, friendly. I've run into him at the grocery stores down in Florida. I've run into him in all kinds of situations. And he's always been a really great, honest person.
That's cool.
Apparently, I owe him $50.
Yeah, Miguel.
That's a bad motherfucker, bro.
Miguel shorted him on accident, $50. We found out in the interview. So we, all right, let's go to your hero. All right, so you get through Kimbo. You're now 2-0. I tell you what, man, you told a lot of people to shut up. And the way you handled the post-fight interview, what screwed me up the most was it was like we're watching a movie and you were like, I already knew the ending. I belong here. And everyone's like, holy shit, the myth of Kimbo, this guy wasn't even fazed. And yeah, dude, man, it made a lot of people quiet. So when I talk about like the UFC kind of setting you up, there's a guy named Joey Beltran, who's the bare knuckle boxing heavyweight champion right now. And Joey is known for his ability to take punishment and cardio. And all he does is just wait for windows and openings. And he is very difficult to beat. You're 2-0, he's 12-3. And you guys end up being fight of the night at UFC 119.
So we got fight of the night.
Yes.
And Chris accidentally got awarded fight of the night that night by the guy who gives the checks out. And so Chris got a $70,000 bonus check that night, and I didn't know I got it. So they call Chris the next night or the next morning, and they're like, hey, Chris, sorry to tell you, but there's been a mistake. You didn't win fight of the night. You have to give that $70,000 check back. And Chris is like, what? Like, what are you talking about? They're like,
yeah, I did already.
Oh, dude, it was insane, man. Absolutely insane, dude. So actually, that's what Chris done, but I stole his bonus. I actually took a $70,000 bonus from Chris one time.
Chris actually is on another run. He's like, I'm back. I'm on another run. He'll be back in like 2 minutes. So here's the thing about Joey Beltran. You dominated the first 2.5 minutes of that first round. He is one of the best nails in all of combat sports. Dude, you hit him with everything. And he weathered the storm. He landed a big punch where you kind of stumbled and he gets a takedown. That first round was really difficult to call. That was like one of your first rounds that I saw where you faced real adversity. Do you recall that?
No, I don't at all.
Well, yeah. Well, how do you feel about Beltran? Because like, I was going to say with Kimbo, you know, obviously the UFC wanted him to win, but neither of you was like had a lot of training. Mike Brown also talked about how, like, he fought Ray Mercer, an Olympic gold medalist, and he didn't have comparable training. You don't have, now with Joey Beltran, you're talking about a guy who's got a lot of experience now.
Junkyard dog.
Did you feel the difference?
Yeah, but I knew, I was told that Joey was tough, like tough. So I expected it to, I didn't expect it to suck. I just expected it to be, not easy. And I remember the fight. I remember going on. I remember I hit him. I felt like with everything.
All the time.
I felt like my hands were magnets to his face. And I just landed everything. But it just, he was like a Rock'em Sock'em robot. Like, it just didn't go anywhere. And I was like, what the hell? And we were in exchange one time and he hit me with like a hook or a straight or something. I was like, oh shit. Like, that was a good punch, man. It kind of surprised me. But like, I don't remember him taking me down. I don't remember that. I must have gotten back up, I'm guessing.
You know, he rode out the round in the top position of round one. Okay. Second round, you punished him. You kept it all on your feet. And the third round is where Joey traditionally breaks everybody because he's pressure. And somehow he ran into a guy that not only hits hard, can outstrike him, but also has good cardio. Like, you almost knocked out Joey Beltran, which, and that's an impossible feat, at least at this stage in his career.
Yeah, he was durable for sure. And I remember, like, I remember afterwards, I was like, damn, dude, like, I couldn't believe I couldn't knock him out. Like, it was just surprising because I felt like I hit him with so much. He was durable, but I remember afterwards, he came to my after party because I was in Indianapolis and like we lived there, and he came to my after party because we found out we won fight of the night, and he was so devastated, he was so upset that he lost, and then he got the phone call that we got a $70,000 bonus, and he's like, dude, that just changed my life, and so he showed up at the after party, and he's like, do you mind I'm here, and I'm like, fuck no, bro, like, let's set it off, man. And we had a great time, and Joey and I have been in contact like for a long time ever since.
Okay, so you're cornered by Tom Erickson.
Yeah.
Did you spend most of your camp with him in like Lafayette?
Yeah, at Purdue. Yeah, for sure. Me okay. And Sean McCorkle, and that's when Chris fought Matt Serra.
Yeah.
And we fully expected Sean McCorkle to lose to Mark Hunt.
Mark Hunt.
We expected him to lose so badly that we were starting to pack up his gear, all of his stuff, because we thought he was going to come in and be like negative and harping on all this stuff, like just negative energy and entity. And he won, and we were just befuddled, man. Like, what just happened? I mean, it was amazing. And he came back and he was in the best mood. Obviously, he's so elated and so happy. And then, like, it just fed the rest of us, man. Like, it was incredible. And it was amazing, man. It was, and then like afterwards, that's when I fired Malky. Like,
yeah, okay, that's my next question. He's getting interviewed by Joe Rogan, does his speech, and he goes, oh, wait, one more thing, grabs the microphone back, and you go, Malky, you're fired. What was that all about?
Well, so Malky pulled a hustle on me, and he met me in the Vegas airport. I was taking a piss. He was waiting outside at the front. And I walked outside and he's like, hey, you're Matt Mitrione, right? And I said, yeah. Hey, he's like, you just beat Kimbo. He's like, I'm telling you, I'm a manager. He's like, I can get you all this money, whatever else. And I said, okay, well, what kind of money are we talking about? He said, I can get you $25,000, you know, from at least two sponsors. We can get you way more than this and blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, man. I was like, I'll make you a deal. Because I think I was self-managed at the time. I can't remember. And I was like, I'm making a deal. You get me 25 G's before I leave Vegas, right? I think it was probably a Thursday. I was leaving on Sunday. You get me 25 G's before I leave Vegas, I'll say you're worth it. Because it's 3 days. You strike up a new sponsorship, I'll do it. Okay. Saturday. I just come over to Luxor. So I go to Luxor, and I'm sitting. He's sitting with this dude at a two-person table at, like, the little taco cantina on the second floor at the Luxor. And he's sitting there at his two-person table. He's like, pull a seat up. So I pull a seat up, and it's this dude, middle-aged guy. And he's like, hey, this is Bob, right? Okay, Bob, what do you do? He's like, well, I run this sports memorabilia store that's in the Luxor on the first floor. He's like, no. He told me he did something with the Luxor, like an executive VP or something, blah, blah. He's like, so what we're going to do is the Luxor is going to sponsor you. We're going to get a $15,000 cash, but then we're also going to do, a week-long penthouse suite stay, all expenses paid, and the Luxor and blah, blah, blah. So you can come out here, do whatever. We'll give you a penthouse, whatever you want, and yada, yada, for 7 days, for a week. And I was like, you know what? That doesn't total out to 15 Gs, but you made something happen. I'm impressed. Okay, cool. So then as we go along, every sponsorship he said he landed or scored fell through. Every single one. And then I come to find out that the dude that was the Luxor VP was his runner's father, who was a worker at a sports memorabilia store. And the dude never even worked. He just hustled the dude to tell me this, so I'd sign with him. It wasn't even the truth. So then I found all that shit out, and I was like, dude, what a dirty bastard. You know, I couldn't believe it. So then the dude only got me $5,000 or maybe like $3,500. I can't remember what it was. But at that time, for Kimbo and for all my other fights that I had afterwards, I was pulling down like $35,000 to $60,000 a fight. And then this dude pulls me down this, like, you lost your fucking mind? Like, after Kimbo, I think I had like $65,000 for fighting Kimbo alone. Right. So then all of a sudden I get five G's and you're totally bailed everything. I was like, you're gone. And then like him and this is when I was training up in what do you call it? I was training up in Milwaukee. Yeah, I was training up in Milwaukee. And he was arguing with my ex-wife, Tina. He's arguing with her a whole bunch and a bunch of other stuff. And I was a middleman between stuff because everything he was saying wasn't true. And my ex-wife was paying more attention to it. So she was catching on all these lies. And I'm like, yo, what the hell's going on here? What's this and what's that? And blah, 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 and yada, yada. Now, granted, like we were starting to go through a divorce at the time. We weren't doing well, like marriage-wise, but like she was still in control of my finances. So he was trying to bail in that situation. He was telling her one thing and telling me another, and things weren't balancing out. And so that's when I was like, you know what, dude? You can't disrespect her like that, even though I'm getting divorced. You got to go. And that's what happened.
Yeah, you publicly did it. Hey, Miguel, let Chris in. You publicly did it. And, you know, we just had Hector Lombard on. And yeah. Lombard also went all in on Melky.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like one of the bigger managers. It's interesting. Hey, Chris, we were just talking about the $70,000 that Matt took from you. Me. Yeah, he said he made some phone calls and made that happen.
Hey, Chris is fantastic at trying to hold my money for a couple of days.
Hey, yeah.
That was the worst story of all time, man. Can you believe that? They had cash in hand. Hey, you tell them what I said. I said at one point, I said, man, I already cashed that thing. And they go, yeah, it's Sunday, Chris. They know I didn't cash it offline.
Oh, in the casino, you should. See, the thing is, that's where they're really low because, you know, you really
keep it.
The bottom line is you reprimand or even fire the fucker who made the mistake, but you don't fucking take it off a guy's plate. You just don't do it to your...
There was no way. They didn't know what to do. They had no clue what to do in that situation because they had never made a mistake that significant before.
Yeah.
I'm glad to be the guy they learned on. You know what I mean? So I'm the guy.
You're always the guy. Hey, how was the call, Chris?
Oh, I'm still on it.
They're still on now.
I'm letting them do it. I'm not taking runs anymore.
That's dedication. That's dedication right there, buddy.
No. We've been on two, man. We had this wreck, and then there's a power line down. So you don't do anything there. We're just sitting there making sure nobody gets power lines in their way.
Responsible. I get it.
Very all noble. Right. Yeah. So where are we at, Mike? Tell me what's going on. All
right. So we're in a sports fight, Chris.
We just fired Malky.
He just fired Melky. Good move. I like that.
That was funny, you know, on TV.
we've been kind of like, we got a clips channel where we put everything over there, and we're going to have a certain file for Malky because we keep running into him with people we interview, and it's never good. It's never good.
Hey, parasites are always around, buddy.
Did you ever have a good experience with Matt? You went from the Pav to Malky. Now, like, how do you recover from that? Or did you just stick to self-management after that?
Well, then I went to another one of Chris's managers, which was Audie Attar. And that lasted for a little bit. And then I went to a guy who left Audie Attar, who was Matt Apteker. And I like Matt. I like Matt a whole lot, actually. I think Matt's a really good dude. Yeah. I think Matt's one of the very few extremely honest people in the sport. And I felt like Matt always had a sincere answer, whether it was what you wanted to hear or not. I always valued what he did and how he did it. But I just felt like it got to a point where I needed to have just a different direction. But I only had like two fights left in my career. Maybe, I think just two fights left by the time we got rid of that. But like, in my opinion, I think if I were an athlete, if I were a fighter now, I would seriously entertain the thought of fighting or having Matt represent me for sure.
Really? Okay. Yeah. So you're 3-0 right now. You've just beat Joey Beltran, who I think that kind of threw a wrench in the UFC's plans because they had figured for sure he'd get through you. And you had a fantastic performance. So they put you up against Tim Hague in the UFC fight night for the troops.
Yeah.
This is when you start waving off glove touches. You want nothing to do with those anymore.
Yeah.
Now, hold on, Mike. Have you talked about your theory with Matt and his hand gestures yet? Have you talked about that?
No, I have not. We're going to work there our way towards that.
Okay, because I want to hear about this because I mean, it's going to get weird. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Matt.
Well, where are we at? What am I answering?
Okay, so, well, I mean, Tim Hague, he's you're 2-0 right now. You're 3-0 right now. You got Tim Hague at UFC Fight Night January 2nd, 2011. And Hague is 12-4. Like, there's really not much move for them because you've got such a small record. But they're throwing you in there with guys with a lot more experience than yourself.
Yeah, yeah. We felt like Chris and I felt, and Coach Pat, felt that we were different than the rest of the heavyweights because I was more mobile and had a different mentality than most. Like, even though I had power, that I wasn't a Rock'em Sock'em robot. You know, I could be if I wanted to be, but we didn't want that to be my path. So Chris was always aggressively preaching, move your goddamn feet, get out of the way, be elusive, don't take punches for no reason. And he would always make me move because I could. And I think that's where he sold me on myself that, listen, maybe you are really a different soul, a different entity. And then we saw a fight where somebody went in to touch gloves. And when they went in to touch gloves, dude ducked under and shot on him, held him down and just absolutely molested dude for a whole entire round. And Chris looked at me at the next practice and was like, hey, did you see that? And I said, yeah. And he's like, don't ever touch gloves again. He's like, it's not worth your time because you're not a wrestler. He's like, if that's legal and somebody's going to have as much cowardice in him to do something like that, he's like, then that's your fault for letting him do it. He's like, so don't do it. And I was like, you know what? You're right. And so I never did it again.
I knew that, you know, Matt was making a name for himself as far as people weren't going to throw punches with him. And they were going to take any advantage they have to. You know how it gets when you start getting climbing that ladder, people just want to win at all costs. And I knew they'd have no problem with taking this guy down and holding him down, you know. So I was like, get him trying to avoid that if all possible. Do what you got to do, man. I don't care. You can be friends afterwards, but during that fight, not a chance.
So you had mentioned you like to model yourself after Dominic Cruz.
Yeah.
So when does that come into play? Because obviously you're kind of newer to the sports compared to everybody else. Where do you pick like his style up to kind of model yourself after?
So we were traveling a lot. Ed Jones and I didn't know anything about the sport and I knew nothing. I knew nobody in the sport. So Ed Jones was like an encyclopedia. He was one of our training partners and he knew everything about everybody and he knew everybody. And so as a result from that, we found ourselves traveling, me and Ed, we would travel across the country and we would go to any gym we could because we still didn't have any heavyweights at the time. So I was a vagrant. And we would float around and we would go to California, we'd go to San Diego, go to LA, go to Florida, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Chicago, Arizona. We'd go everywhere just finding people to train with. And so we floated around for a long time. And then, and obviously we would come back or whatever else, but like, if it wasn't for Ed Jones being able to train with me or travel with me, then I wouldn't know who these people are. Like I would literally have no clue. So he would be like, well, hey, this is the heavyweight. He trains over here. He needs a heavyweight. I reached out to him or his manager and they said, come on out on this day. So Ed and I would get tickets. We'd fly out there. We'd stay in a hotel and then we'd get stuff figured out from there.
That's so cool.
We traveled everywhere all the time. Because you have, and so MMA, as you know this now, MMA is dead in the Midwest. There's no talent and there's no camps in the Midwest at all. It's not like back in the day when overtime MMA, overtime wrestling was there. There's nobody. So we kind of find ourselves in a spot where we had to go. And Coach Pat and Chris understood. And there was a little bit of tension between me and Coach Pat simply because I don't think I handled it properly, like as far as cornering. I didn't realize that cornering was such a delicate situation for coaches back in the day. You know, like I didn't realize that there was almost a good position. Like Coach Pat always hears me. Okay, well, like, but Coach Duke and Pat Byrne and Chris was like, I got feelings on it. I said a little while. And so I was kind of like unwelcome in my own family because I didn't necessarily do a great job of navigating that, partly due to ignorance. And then like over time, we kind of like a lot of that was water under the bridge. And by that time I had met Coach Henry Hooft. Yeah, but I didn't know that Coach Henry was going to be so relevant. In my opinion, Coach Pat wasn't a stand-up guy. Coach Pat was just a coach. So I thought that it was more important to have training partners versus coaches because a training partner can actually get in, see what I'm doing wrong, correct me in the middle of it, right? But they have a hands-on approach versus a coach. So then by the time Tyrone Spong came down to Florida, that's when I was like, okay, now I'm ready to make the move to come down to Florida and get some time in. And that was right after I fought. Well, that was right before I fought Czech Congo.
Right.
So I fought Czech. I was 5-0. I just beat Christian Moorcraft. I was 5-0. And then,
so wait, before we get there, when you fought Christian Moorcraft, I had thought that you went to Extreme Couture in Vegas for that.
I probably did. Remember I said I was traveling a whole bunch.
Okay. Because I thought they were cornering you.
Yeah, I did. I was at Randy's for a while. And Neil Melanson, that's where I met Neil. And I think Neil was probably cornering me too. I can't remember who was cornering me then or not.
You know, the thing with Christian Moorcraft is he's 6-0 and he needed under 8 minutes to get there. Like that's that was a legit, really tough guy. And you went through him and you knocked him out in the second round. The guy never left the first 2 minutes of the first round. You drag him into the second round and you get the knockout and you had very little problems with him.
Yeah. I wasn't threatened by him. There wasn't much, but then again, I wasn't threatened by Czech Congo either. Like, I was bored in the middle of the fight. I didn't know how to handle somebody that really didn't want to compete or fight. Everybody else I'd ever fought to that point had a huge sack of balls on him and wasn't afraid to let him go and to fight and to earn a paycheck. Nobody was a career guy. So I didn't realize that this dude would let me, would take my momentum, let me back him into the wall, and okey-doke me, sit around, knock him when he punches, take me down and lay on top of me and just steal rounds. I wasn't hip to that. I didn't know that people fought like that. Like, to me, that's the epitome of cowardice. And at the same time, that's the reason why he's been around for 1,000 years.
Yeah, he was 16-6. Yeah, he was, 16-6-2? So you're looking at a guy with a lot of experience.
Yeah.
And it was his 15th UFC fight, I might add, yeah, as well. And, yeah, and had you won that, I think you may have been up for a title shot. I think they would just, yeah, would have said, we can't figure this out. He surprised everybody. Just throw him in the deepest water possible. I think if you would have won that fight, you would have been there.
That's correct. I believe that's accurate.
Yeah.
Now, so, you mentioned Tyrone Spong. He's like a phenom from Holland that dabbled in MMA but came over from kickboxing and stuff. Did you learn there? Because, I mean, you're a big, strong guy, big punch, big athlete, but now we're talking real Dutch kickboxing technique. Is it something that you took well to?
So I lost a check, and I didn't realize it. I thought it was like a strained app, but I had a completely torn sports hernia. My entire pelvic floor was torn out. I couldn't kick. I couldn't get up off the ground. I couldn't explode in any kind of situation. I didn't realize it. I had the surgery about a month afterwards because it wouldn't go away. I thought I was in New Orleans doing something with the UFC, and it was Melvin, myself, and I can't remember who the other person was. It was Mark Munoz, myself, Melvin, and one other person. And we were doing these workouts with a plyo ball. And I felt like this really sharp burn, almost like, for lack of a better way to express it, it was like you drink a soda, and you keep your mouth closed and you burp and it goes through your nose and burns like that. It was that burn in my throat. And it was really painful. And that apparently was all those pelvic floor muscles tearing out. So I didn't realize it until after the fight. Then I go get it done by a doctor named Dr. Myers in Philadelphia. He gets it done. We do the surgery. And it took a while to recover. So I ended up going down to Florida then with Henry and Tyrone Spong. And that's when I ended up joining the Black Zillions. And that's when I learned so much about fighting, because I had guys like Tyrone and Alistair Overeem and Thiago Silva and Buchecha and Braulio Estima and Cyborg Abreu and Pablo Popovich and all these dudes like that were Jake Shields and like all these great, great fighters that were down there literally every single day. And it was like a murderer's row. Anthony Johnson, Rashad. I mean, it was anybody you could imagine was down there. And we were working day in, day out, all together, like beating the living shit out of each other, but finding each other's secrets and weaknesses and blah, blah, blah. And it was an incredible experience.
Was that hard to leave Indianapolis?
Florida?
Nobody knows.
In a very complicated way, no. Even though I had two young children, my ex-wife and I weren't getting along at all. It was a very unhealthy situation to be in. So I could get away and train and focus. And it was a very safe place for me to be, where I could train with some of the best in the world, get better, and then not have other distractions.
So your next fight, Shane Carlin pulls out of the Tough 16 finale. And you take a fight last minute, December 15, 2012. You called out Roy Nelson. You jumped in real quick.
I was out for 13 months and I had two surgeries. And I was supposed to fight Phil DeFreeze. And I felt like fighting Phil DeFreeze was a gimme. I felt like I was going to smoke him no matter what. And it was a lose-lose for me. I win. Cool. Good job. I lose. You're completely fucked. Nobody cares about Phil DeFreeze. And nobody cares if you beat him. when Shawn pulled out, they called me up and they offered me Roy. Actually, that's not true. I called up and offered myself. And they said, well, why do you want to do that? We have Phil. And I said, because Roy is a win-win. If I lose to him, I've been out for 13 months. Nobody expects me to win. If I beat him, then I just dethroned one of the top five guys in the UFC at the time. So after all that time, then I'm right back in the conversation I was a while ago. And they said, okay. And then I fought him. My mouthpiece fell out, hit me with an uppercut, and I lost. And that started win some, lose some, win some, lose some.
Did, when you had mentioned you had surgery, did the UFC pay for that, or did you have to come out of pocket?
UFC paid for it. Paid for the first one. The second one, I broke my hand. I threw an uppercut, and I hit Ryan Jimmo in his forehead, and I broke my hand. Like, I don't know if you can see it, but I have a scar on my first right there.
Okay. Yeah.
I got a plate, six screws in my bone right there. And I broke that. I was supposed to fight a dude named Rob Broughton. He's a British dude. I was supposed to fight
Rob. Next. Yeah. That's next. Okay, Chris, you got to hear. This is amazing. So Rob Broughton, he drops out of a fight. They give him Matt Mitrione, August 4th, 2012. He says, I got personal issues. Can't do this. Sorry. The UFC doesn't give you another fight. They just shelf you. And then they put you October 10th, UFC on Fox, against Rob Broughton, of which he says he can't do that. So they release him and they shelf you again until like April 6th in Sweden. What was going on? I got a little insight. I called some people in Europe in regards to it. What did they tell you about Rob Broughton?
Something about a visa. He lied about something on his visa application or something.
He just took 8 years in jail about a month and a half ago, because he was the muscle guy for the mafia, the cocaine ring. He never touched the cocaine, but he would go and collect the money.
No shit.
Yeah, so he was with Wolf Slayer's gym. Most of those mafia-type guys in Europe were out of London Shoot Fighters. That's for like Lee Murray, Mark Epstein. That's where all those guys operate out of. I've asked Mark Epstein to come on here several times, and I would keep it really kosher. He agreed. I think he watched one episode and then he goes, oh, yeah, I ain't touching that. So he reads my messages, but now he won't respond. So Broughton was a part of like the whole MMA crew over there was involved in like illegal activity. And he was one of the muscle guys. Yeah. Why did the UFC shelf you?
I don't know. My answer is always yes, but luckily they did, because I had broken my hand and I was going to fight Rob 7 weeks after I broke it. And I didn't have the money to say no. So regardless, I was just going to, hopefully my incision healed enough. The doctors would let me fight. And I was just going to re-break it in the fight. Like, that was the plan. Like, all right, well, let's re-break my hand. Fuck it. Let's go get paid and let's see what happens. And then it got canceled. And then, all that madness happened with Phil DeFreeze and whatever else. It was wild, man. It was a wild time.
So you take your last fight, Roy Nelson, December 15, 2012. Your next fight's in Sweden, April 6, 2013, UFC fight night, against a guy you had already mentioned, Phil DeFreeze.
Yeah.
So you were comfortable taking it. I mean, you got two losses. Where's your mindset at?
Well, I knew I was going to beat Phil DeFreeze, but my mindset was that my losses were 13 months apart, and I had said yes to every fight they had offered me, so I wasn't saying no. So I wasn't really tripping about me losing two in a row. It just was what it was. And then when I fought Phil, like I said, I just knew I was going to beat him. I even told the referee before the fight, it was Mark Goddard. And I told, and I don't ever remember refs, right? Ever. Like, I told Mark, I was like, listen, I understand he's your countryman and we're in Sweden. I'm going to knock his ass out. And I don't want to be dribbling his head off the canvas. So make sure that we handle this thing properly. Like, don't give him more time because I'm not trying to damage his brain. And he was like shocked. I told him that. And I was like, listen, I'm just telling you, it's not going to be a long fight. And I knocked him out in 15 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, and Henry, because Michael Johnson, Chris, you were there, weren't you? Oh, Chris, on you.
Yeah, I was there. I was there.
He was your translator.
You remember when I told Mark Goddard that, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Remember we always used to say, talk to the referee, tell him, don't stop the fight, blah, 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 and then you told him that, too. And he was like, yeah, he didn't know what to say. I don't think he'd heard that before.
Yeah, I don't think probably not. And it was a really interesting situation because once we beat him, it was like, all right, well, we knew we were going to beat him. And then I got suspended for the comments on Air Hawani show. And then
No. That was not then, was it? Was that then?
Yeah, it was him. It was him.
Okay.
Well, here, let's rewind just a little bit, but we're going to open up that door as well. You had almost gotten arrested the night before in Sweden.
Oh, yeah, because that dude.
Would you mind walking us through that?
How'd you hear about that? Who told you about that?
Hey, dude, I got contacts, brother. I'm the MMA detective. Yeah.
That wasn't even me. That one wasn't even me.
Nah.
Was it another fight? Was it another fight or was it a dude in the bar? What was it?
It was an undercover cop.
Oh, the night before. Oh, the night before the fight.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Talking about after the fight. You're talking about after the fight when you almost got arrested.
Yeah, you got a two-piece. I was going to wait for him to try to admit one and then go to the other. Okay.
I got a two-piece. So I love doner kebabs, right? So I went to get a kebab. I was walking back by myself with a hoodie on and some music headphones on. And these two dudes walk up next to me. And like they're like on each side of me. And so like they're like right next to me. And so I'm looking and I kind of slow down. And this dude shows me a badge and he's like, hey, he's like, I need you to come with me. And I was like, I'm not coming with you anyway. I don't know who the fuck you are. And he's like, no, you need to come with me. And he grabs me. Well, I shove the dude because I don't know who he is. And I'm like, hey, listen, I don't know who you are, but don't touch me again. Like, and then another cop pulls up from around. So there's three of them now. And they're like, listen, you're going to come with us and this is what's going to happen. I'm like, listen, let me tell you what's going to happen. I'm right by my fighter hotel. My name is Matt Mitrione. I fight in the UFC. I'm fighting tomorrow night. You can go over there and talk to my boss in the lobby, but I'm not going with y'all anywhere. So fuck y'all. And then there just happened to be like a couple of MMA journalists that were around right within earshot. And they saw what was going on. They jumped in. They started telling the cops what was going on. And they're like, hey, listen, this is who this guy is. They thought that I just robbed somebody at a club or outside of a something. I don't know. So they thought I was this dude. And they wanted to take me in for interrogation because I thought I was this guy. And then they were like, no, it wasn't him. He's a fighter, blah, blah, blah. And they let me go. So that was that situation. Then I don't know. I don't know what Chris is talking about the situation afterwards.
Well, first of all, let me tell you one thing. The reason Matt was by himself was we had a tradition with our camp was all the corner men the night before the fight, it's their responsibility to go out drinking and partying, you know, and leaving the fighter to his own device. That's kind of what we do every time. So
they have peace.
Matt was on his own.
They have peace.
Matt was on his own to think with his thoughts while we were out there, you know, having a time went on. So that's what happened there. Now. As far as you, okay, now you continue, Mike. I'm not sure what we're talking about here besides that.
So, Matt, the after party, you also had another incident.
Yeah, I did, man. I did. There was I don't remember what the situation was exactly. If it was a fighter, or if it was just a dude. But like, I was Phil DeFreeze was there. We were drinking, and then some dude stepped up to me and was like, he was salty about something. I can't remember what it was. And I remember him like he tried to grab me, and I was like, hey, listen, dude, I'm not the guy. And I was walking to the bathroom or something. So I was alone. I'm like, listen, dude, don't do that. I don't know who you are. Don't touch me. And the dude tried to grab me again and I slapped him and he dropped his drink and like he fell over and luckily the bouncers saw it all. And they're like, hey, did this guy just touch you? They asked me, hey, did this guy just touch you? I'm like, yeah, he grabbed me. And that's why I slapped him because he wouldn't let me go. And like, okay. And they grabbed this dude and dragged him out. Beer was all over this dude. He peed on himself, whatever else. And like, they dragged this dude out, like by his hair and his sweatshirt.
I thought you kicked him right in the face. I thought you kicked him right in the face.
Maybe that might have happened. I can't remember.
You know, Miguel, Matt, you're about 6'2", 6'3". You know, every bit of 245 at that time.
250.
Don't 250. There you go. I don't believe that guys would just, like, put their hands on you. Like, it's just.
Brother, it used to happen so much, man. It used to happen all the time. All the time.
Yeah, it's crazy. That's crazy.
Let me ask you. You said you're talking to the cops. You said, "Hey, no, we're gonna go back to the hotel. Talk to my boss." What'd you have in mind? Dana, Joe Silva, who was there? Or your management? What was going through your head?
Any of them? They were all in the hotel bar. Okay. So I knew as soon as I walked in the hotel, I was gonna come up with them. They're gonna be like, "Hey, dude, leave him alone." And they have enough juice. Whether it's Mark Ratner, whether it's Mike Mersch, Dana or Joe Silva, didn't matter. They all had enough juice to be like, "Hey, dude, this situation's got to go. This isn't real." And I knew that was going to happen. So I was like, "Listen, that's why I was like, I'm not spending any time with you out here. You guys out here are my business. That's my business. We'll go inside and get this thing handled, but I'm not going to handle it in any kind of loss in translation position."
Okay, that was fantastic. That's my buddy Mitrione, and on cue, just like I would expect, his phone died. So we will get him back, though, to do more, because that dude's just a great interview, in my opinion.
You know, not only is he fun, he takes you through it. And
he took you through his house!
Yeah. You know, next time, Chris, we got to get him to go through his refrigerator. But we got to see what's going on in there.
He'll love to, trust me. Yeah,
the fun thing about him, too, is like, you kind of open up avenues. Hey, kind of knew this happened. He's more than willing to talk about it. He was in a really unfortunate situation, being painted incredibly horrible on The Ultimate Fighter. And I think he surprised everybody, including himself, that he could actually do this and excel at it. Because, it was incredibly impressive that the run that he went on.
You know, we've had a couple of them on here. And, you know, it's a term used for other things, but I think it's a term that really fits Matt Mitrione and Eric Anders, and you're talking about a two-sport athlete at that level. And that's very rare. So, you know, he'd already excelled it to such a high level at another sport that you knew I thought going in that we were going to get a guy who was a lot more mental and motivation and mental work and stuff than he was letting on with Meathead. And I think I was right.
Yeah. You know, Chris, I think what came through is the bond that you two had. Like, at some point in your relationship, you sat him down and said, "You got to leave the coop." And by doing that, it showed that you genuinely cared about him. And athletes like Miguel said, that have been around the corner, a few corners, they see that and recognize, wait a minute, that guy genuinely cares about me. And you really can't say that when you're on your way up, because there's so many hangers on.
I was really fortunate when I was training and fighting. I knew I had people around me who cared about me and, you know, didn't. That's just how I was brought into the sport and raised in it. And I look back now and it's a rare thing, like you said. So people wanted what was best for me and they did what was best for me. And how can I not do that for other people? And at the time, there was just no really, nobody could train with him. I can't give him a good picture. He's 80 pounds bigger than me. You know, I'm trying to do something. Bench presses me off. So it's like, you got to go do something different, Matt. I mean, but like I said, he always, I'm one of the few people I think he actually listens to in the world, probably.
So Miguel, we got another guy, our second guy dumping on Melky Kawa. We had Hector Lombard, now Matt Mitrione. We got some more Pav stories. We're probably going to have to, you know, edit those at some point and put them on our Clips channel. But guys, if you guys can like, share, subscribe, our growth is going through the roof and it's just beginning. It's actually kind of exciting for us to, you know, log in and see our uploads go up, and it's seriously appreciated. So please like, share, subscribe, leave a comment.
Yep. Across the board, the comments, we try to respond and, we love hearing from the people and stuff. And also ideas, anything else you got for us that we want to set the MMA detective? He's our little pit bull. we'll put them on it. We'll get it done. We'll get it done. So thank you very much, folks.
Thanks, guys.